Good morning. This is the clerk of the court, and it is 10 a.m. in Washington, D.C. Presiding Judge Greenberg, the conference is configured for oral argument this morning with recording and live video streaming now up and running. Counsel are prepared to argue, and all participants are ready to proceed.
Very good. You may call the court.
The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. I'm Judge Greenberg. I'm joined by Judges Toth and Lauer in the matter of Hayes versus McDonough. Will counsel, beginning with the appellant's counsel, please make your appearance.
Nikki Lazara for the appellant with Jillian Berner.
Counsel for the secretary.
Lance Staley for the Secretary, Your Honor, with Ken Walsh.
Thank you. Will counsel for the appellant let me know how much time you wish to reserve?
10 minutes, Your Honor, for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. All right, let's proceed. Counsel for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. This appeal stems from the board's denial of waiver to Mrs. Hayes for an overpayment of a widow's pension. The board in this decision committed several errors, including misapplying the term misrepresentation as used in the statute and regulations. The board also failed to provide an adequate statement of reasons and bases for concluding Mrs. Hayes should be denied a waiver, since they failed to meet their burden that misrepresentation or bad faith occurred. Your Honors, we are here once again because the board has failed to assign a consistent definition of misrepresentation, and it is clear that since deference is not owed, that there needs to be a definition provided for future use in these decisions. We ask this court to apply the definition of misrepresentation found in Black's Law Dictionary, which states that misrepresentation is the act of making a false or misleading assertion about something with intent to deceive. First, however...
Just a minute, counsel. This is Judge Greenberg. Aren't we being asked to interpret the statute rather than, and how will Black's Law Dictionary help us? What was congressional intent here?
Your Honor, That was going to be my first point. We aren't sure what Congress intended from the statute. And so we must go first to the Chevron analysis, which is when the court reviewing an agency's construction of a statute must first determine, one, whether Congress's intent is clear from the statute. If it's plain and unambiguous, the inquiry ends. However, if the statute is silent or ambiguous on the specific issue, the court will defer to the agency's interpretation so long as it's based on a permissible construction of the statute. But looking to 38 U.S.C. 5302, Congress's intent remains unclear and is ambiguous since it's subject to more than one reasonable interpretation.
Remind me what that statute says.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me pull it up here. 38 U.S.C. 5302C is the pertinent part here, which states right. That the recovery of any payment or the collection of any indebtedness may not be waived under this section if, in the Secretary's opinion, there exists in connection with the claim for such waiver an indication of fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith on the part of the person or persons having an interest in obtaining a waiver of such recovery or the collection of such indebtedness.
What's ambiguous about that? Isn't that language clear and unmistakable that it's the opinion of the secretary that we should be reviewing? As for any other administrative agency, is it unreasonable or capricious and so forth? Isn't that the standard we should be applying?
Your Honor, the ambiguity lies with the term misrepresentation specifically. We have seen in this decision alone many different interpretations of what the term is as applied by the board. And we've seen in our brief, we've offered several definitions of the term. The secretary has offered several definitions of the term.
Can you, sorry to interrupt, counsel. You're doing very well in responding to my interruptions. But in the end, aren't you asking us to supply once and for all a legal interpretation with regard to the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. We are asking this court to apply a consistent definition that can be used in future decisions because, like I made mention of before, the term misrepresentation has changed throughout these board decisions. And so it remains unclear of what misrepresentation means, what the claimant is to look for when the board is determining that they've committed misrepresentation in their waiver claim. So we need a clear and consistent definition of this ambiguous term.
Go ahead with your argument.
Okay. Legislative history is unclear as to the statute, and all other tools of statutory construction lend no further into dissolving the ambiguity. We only know of what the misrepresentation must be more than, according to the regulations, but not actually what it is. In Kaiser, genuine ambiguity was described in some instances as regulations that may not directly or clearly address every issue, and when applied to some fact patterns, they may prove susceptible to more than one reasonable reading.
Sorry to interrupt you. So it's your argument that fraud, misrepresentation, and bad faith are three separate sort of acts of intent, would you be arguing that this is sort of one phrase, maybe restating the same action, maybe in three different ways? Does that make sense?
I think I understand what you're asking. Specifically,
you would isolate misrepresentation, right? So your argument really does not pertain at all to bad faith or fraud, right?
Not other than inadequate reasons and bases for bad faith, but no, we are focusing on misrepresentation here and the lack of defining the term properly as according to the statute and regulations.
Okay, because the reason I mentioned that is, one could argue that this is really just a phrase, right? That fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith maybe might all be referring to the same type of culpability, right? The other way to argue is that these are three separate, one would be fraudulent, that would have a certain intent. The next would be misrepresentation, maybe that would have a lower intent. And then bad faith would, maybe between the middle, right? Here, we sort of isolated on misrepresentation as the sort of sole relevant term in your argument. Is that right?
Yeah, the reason we are focusing on misrepresentation is because there is a definition that in the regulations for bad faith. However, there's not one for fraud or misrepresentation. And the board in this decision didn't indicate that there was any fraud on the part of Mrs. Hayes. So to us, that indicates that there are different levels that they are looking at in terms of intent. But circling back to our argument, if after all the tools of interpretation have been exhausted, there still remains genuine ambiguity, the issue of whether deference is owed arises. The board in its decision supplied a post hoc rationalization of the regulations, and their interpretation is not entitled to deference. When looking to an agency's interpretation of its own regulation controls, unless the interpretation is plainly erroneous or inconsistent with the regulation. Our also requires that in order for deference to apply, the interpretation must reflect the agency's fair and considered judgment on the matter in question.
The position here is there's no official agency definition of misrepresentation, at least not in the... Is there a general counsel interpretation or some type of guidance document that officially defines the term misrepresentation?
Your Honor, we have been unable to find any definition for the term misrepresentation pretty much anywhere, which is part of the reason that we're having an issue and that there is ambiguity, because we're unsure of where the board came up with the definition that they supplied in this case, because it hasn't been used anywhere that we've seen thus far. The VA has merely replaced statutory ambiguity with regulatory ambiguity when looking at both 38 CFR 1.962 and 1.965. Because of the lack of a substantive meaning for the term in the regulations, the board has supplied inconsistent interpretations throughout this case. So in this particular decision on appeal, the board stated, for there to be misrepresentation, there must be willful misrepresentation of a material fact or willful failure to disclose a material fact. And then the misrepresentation must be more than non-willful or mere inadvertence. The board's definition imposes an element of willful failure to disclose a material fact, which, despite the lack of clarity of the plain meaning of the term, is inconsistent with the statute.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I mean, I'm a little confused in the sense that I would expect that a more restrictive definition would be favorable. I mean, what definition would you prefer rather than, I mean, would you prefer that they just read out the element of intent altogether? Because I don't see how that would help Ms. Hayes here.
Your Honor, it's not necessarily about helping Mrs. Hayes, but helping future claimants in general. They defined misrepresentation with the term itself. And so.
Oh, sure. No, but if there were no element of intent, it would be kind of strict liability. So you just filled out the form incorrectly by mistake, right? I mean, that would be a misrepresentation. There would be no intent. Intent would be irrelevant.
Correct.
So there has to be some heightened knowing or willful or specific intent, right? I mean, some of the kind of classic intents, what intent would you propose?
We propose a dictionary definition from Black's Law, which is the act of making a false or misleading assertion about something with intent to deceive.
Okay. So specific intent. Like a specific intent, you would have to knowingly and intentionally go about knowing exactly what you're doing.
Correct. This is a better definition, at least, than what the board has supplied, because the standard for it more closely aligns with the perceived intent of Congress. The statute wasn't meant to be an insurmountable bar to receive waiver, and applying a definition that doesn't use the word itself will allow the claimant adequate chance to argue for waiver and will ensure the board's decision does not go against equity and good conscience, nor will it deny the appellant of due process. This is a pro-veteran and pro-claimant system, and by following the board's definition, it would allow for an extremely low bar for proving misrepresentation. In this case, like you said, failing to update income is concluded as misrepresentation. The definition will create a higher bar, which will follow Congress's intent, and that's why that is the best definition to use in these cases going forward. The definition put forth by the board is an interpretation of the regulation that has not been formally adopted by the agency as an official position, meaning deference is not entitled pursuant to our. This is again evident by the inconsistencies in board decisions. So using the analysis under Chevron, the statute is ambiguous, and looking to our, the agency's interpretation of the statute pursuant to the regulations cannot entitle it to deference. The Supreme Court in Kaiser discussed limits on agency deference and stated that the interpretation must at least emanate from those actors using those vehicles understood to make authoritative policy in the relevant context. The board cannot be held responsible for making authoritative policy decisions at will, because as has been demonstrated in this case, the claimant will be exposed to inconsistent outcomes. In The Kaiser decision also, it was stated that our deference is warranted in instances where the agency's interpretation should implicate its substantive expertise. However, again, the agency has no more specialized knowledge when it comes to applying a substantive meaning for regulatory terms. These are not VA-specific terms, and so deference should not be owed. In Christopher versus Smith-Klein-Beacham, the Supreme Court noted that deference to an agency's interpretation is unwarranted when the agency's interpretation conflicts with prior interpretation, or when it appears that interpretation is nothing more than a convenient litigating position or post hoc rationalization. The board picks apart the regulations to create an opportune standard for the agency that, once again, going back to our, does not reflect the fair and their fair and considered judgment on the matter. The board's definition effectively reads language out of the statute at a level that is not clear from Congress's intent, nor is implied from the regulations. Finally, this court should also decline to give deference to the secretary in their definition, since the definition they provide neither aligns with the statute and regulations nor that of the boards. The secretary defines misrepresentation as the communication of information that is inaccurate or incomplete to a recipient so that the recipient is likely to form a false understanding of some circumstance relevant to the relationship between the communicator and the recipient. However, the Supreme Court in Burlington Truck Lines versus United States stated courts may not accept appellate counsel's post hoc rationalizations for agency action. For the courts to substitute their or counsel's discretion for that of the agency is incompatible with the orderly functioning of the process of judicial review. The secretary makes the argument using the Supreme Court's holding in Williams versus Taylor that when a term is used but is undefined in a statute, that it is assumed to have its ordinary and popularly understood meaning. Nevertheless, the secretary fails to follow its own argument since the definition they have supplied is inconsistent with that of the boards, lending to the fact that the term is ambiguous and should not be afforded deference. However, even if this court were to conclude that misrepresentation is unambiguous and deferred to agency interpretation, the board has failed to meet its burden of proof and has therefore supplied inadequate reasons and bases. The board fails to identify clear facts that support its notion that Mrs. Hayes's actions, according to the supplied definition, rose to the level of misrepresentation. Specifically, according to the board, again, the misrepresentation must be more than non-willful or mere inadvertence. There's nothing indicative from the record that would allow the board to conclude that any action or inaction by Mrs. Hayes was due to more than mere inadvertence. The board simply relies on inferences to deduce this point. The board's use of the term in the definition itself cannot stand as an adequate definition and infringes on the claimant's due process rights, as well as her opportunity to understand the standard the board is using to determine misrepresentation. Under Gilbert versus Jawinski, the board must support its findings with reasons or bases that enable the claimant to understand the precise basis for its decision and facilitates review in this court. That statement must also explain the board's reasons for discounting favorable evidence. The board has failed to meet their burden of proving that Mrs. Hayes misrepresented her income, rendering their reasons wholly inadequate for denying waiver. Finally, the board has also provided an inadequate statement of its reasons and basis in concluding that Mrs. Hayes acted in bad faith when denying her waiver claim. Bad faith is defined under 38 CFR 1.965B, which states that a debtor's conduct exhibits bad faith if such conduct, although not undertaken with actual fraudulent intent, is undertaken with intent to seek an unfair advantage with knowledge of the likely consequences and results in a loss to the government. The board has failed to meet the burden of proof in finding bad faith, as there is no intent to seek an unfair advantage.
Just a minute. Is there some dispute about the facts of this case? Wasn't she in fact overpaid?
She was overpaid, Your Honor.
So the issue is whether under the statute the secretary can waive the recovery of this overpayment?
Correct.
And why should we, what are the standards upon which the secretary can apply the waiver? Isn't that really what this case is all about?
Yes, Your Honor. They found that she was not entitled to a waiver for equity and good conscience reasons because she exhibited bad faith and because she misrepresented her income. But there was no, according to the definition that is supplied in 38 CFR 1.965B, there was nothing to indicate that she had an intent to seek an unfair advantage with knowledge of the likely consequences, which is what I see that my time has ended. With intent to seek an unfair advantage with knowledge of the likely consequences. But there's nothing that the board clearly indicated points to an intent to seek an unfair advantage. She wrote a letter to the board in March of 2014 where she stated, "I am certain in your letter to me, it did state that I was to report any income or change of income, but didn't realize it included income from unemployment compensation or Social Security's widow's pension." And then she stated, "What I'm trying to explain is I did not intentionally commit fraud, misrepresent, or do any of this in bad faith." The only way
I think we understand. Judge okay. Toth, do you have anything further for counsel at this time?
Not right now, maybe on rebuttal.
Right. Judge Lauer?
Yes, I do. So in that letter, the appellant acknowledged essentially knowing that she had to report earned income and then she did not report her earned income. So there's two types of income, unearned and earned. And she acknowledged that she should have reported the unearned, but also failed to report the earned income, correct?
Your Honor, I think more what she was trying to indicate was that she realized that she was sure that the letter stated she was to report that type of income, but she didn't realize what type of income it included. And then she went on to state that she didn't intentionally commit fraud, misrepresent, or do any of this in bad faith. The only thing that the board really pointed to was the fact that she put zero and failed to update her income. That was how they came to that conclusion.
Okay, so how is it that the court could find that there's not plausible support that the record contains evidence of bad faith in the event that it seemed clear that the appellant was required to report both unearned and earned income, and essentially she conceded that she didn't. And I mean, that's where I'm struggling.
I don't think, Your Honor, I don't believe that she conceded that she knew she was to report income. She maybe conceded that the acknowledgement of those letters did state what she was to report, but she didn't realize what it was that she was to report. I don't know if I'm, I mean, when there was no clear pointing of intent to deceive by the board, which is why we're arguing that they didn't supply adequate reasons and bases for concluding that she exhibited bad faith in this case. There was nothing to indicate her intent other than that she put zero.
have no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further, Judge Toth, at this point? All right, fine. Thank you, counsel. We'll turn to the government, please.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your argument.
May it please the court. The board's decision is not arbitrary and capricious because the board articulated a satisfactory explanation for its decision, including a rational connection between the facts found in its determination that appellant affirmatively misreported her income on her March 2009 pension application and engaged in bad faith when she failed to update VA on her earned and unearned income. The statute at 38 U.S.C. 5302 prohibits waiver of an overpayment if, in the opinion of the secretary, there is an indication of fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith. The language of the statute, quote, if in the opinion of the secretary, unquote, indicates that Congress intended to give the secretary discretion to prohibit waiver of an overpayment where there is merely an indication of fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith. While the implementing regulation...
Can you hear me, counsel?
Yes, I can, Your Honor.
On this question, is intent on the part of the appellant necessary in any one of the three categories, whether it's misrepresentation or fraud or...
Certainly in fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation, Your Honor.
Don't we just have evidence, if we have any evidence at all, of misrepresentation? She didn't report this income, whether she knew or didn't know that it should be reported. She didn't. I'm focused on what congressional intent must have been with regard to the secretary's discretion. Is it absolute discretion to waive repayment, or does it have to have a reasonable basis in the facts of each individual case? Would you focus on that?
Yes, Your Honor. I would not go so far to say it's an absolute discretion. It's more like arbitrary and capricious plus or abusive discretion plus. So in the secretary's opinion, it arguably confers a greater discretion, and arguably the reference to an indication of fraud and misrepresentation of bad faith, rather than a finding on those things, points the way. I think that one of the challenges of this case is the overlap between fraud and misrepresentation. So fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation or intentional misrepresentation represents just one part of the corpus of misrepresentation law. So misrepresentation can take many forms. It can be found on a gradation or spectrum of blameworthiness, representing the varieties and nuances of human behavior, from fraudulent misrepresentation to negligent misrepresentation.
Well, yeah. Doesn't that raise the fundamental issue, at least in one of the opponent's arguments, is that as to the adequacy of the reasons and bases in explaining what the secretary was doing in refusing to exercise his discretion under the statute to waive the overpayment?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to, I think I may best answer that question by going through sort of a Chevron analysis, if I may. So the first question is whether the statutory language is silent or ambiguous. So the statute on its face doesn't define or limit the type of misrepresentation other than to set it apart from fraud or fraudulent misrepresentation. But what type of non-fraudulent misrepresentation, and where does the willful misrepresentation found by the board lie on the spectrum? So the legislative history discussed by the court in Reyes v. Nicholson gives us some idea. The court noted in Reyes, when it discussed the legislative history of the 1989 amendment to the then existing statute, that the misrepresentation only include a material misrepresentation. So the statute on its face reads almost like strict liability, because any sort of non-fraudulent misrepresentation, as long as material, precludes waiver. But the secretary chose a more generous, claimant-friendly construction of the statute, because the statute on its face still captures accidental or inadvertent misrepresentation. And the regulation under 1.962B shows a definition of the term. The misrepresentation must be of a material fact and be more than non-willful, that is, unintentional, or merely inadvertent or an accidental oversight. So the regulation would appear to excuse an innocent misrepresentation. Now, the appellant has twice stated that she didn't realize unemployment compensation counted as income, so why isn't this an example of an innocent misrepresentation? Well, in an innocent misrepresentation, the maker of the statement must reasonably believe what she stated is true. But here, I think the facts of the case shows that her statement is not reasonable. So she had been
What facts are they? What are the facts in this case upon which the secretary relied in refusing to waive pursuant to his power to do so under the statute?
Appellant had been in receipt of unemployment compensation prior to at the time of her March 2009 application. In her March 2014 statement, she admitted to receiving unemployment income from 2007 to 2011, and she admitted receiving financial assistance from her family at the time of the application. Yet the pension application instructs that, quote, payments from any source will be counted, unquote. It doesn't say income, it says payments. And it goes on, quote, if you do not receive any payments from one of those sources that we list, write zero in the space. But underlying 36F for public assistance, she affirmatively wrote zero. And she signed and certified the information as true and complete.
Well, isn't public assistance welfare? I mean, broadly speaking. It's not unemployment compensation, is it?
Is it unemployment compensation?
Well, no. Unemployment compensation, as it's commonly understood, is a form of insurance, isn't it?
I think it's commonly...
Don't employers pay into a fund?
Yes, really an insurance fund. But it's not public. But it is also... I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, please.
Go ahead.
It is a form of public assistance. She could also have disclosed it on the line right below that where it requests disclosure of any other source of payment or income.
All right. Go ahead.
So this is not an innocent misrepresentation because she failed to exercise reasonable care in supplying the correct information, and she had a duty to disclose that information. The application form requested disclosure of payments from any source and specifically requested disclosure of public assistance.
Well, here, I'm bothered by this. Sorry, Judge Toth, I'll turn to you in a minute. Counsel, if the appellant was obligated to, by the VA form, to disclose payments from any source, why do you subdivide it into all these other categories? Why not just say all other sources, which includes what? A bequest, a gift, insurance payment? I mean, why do they have these subdivisions if the veteran, or in this case, the widow, is obligated to report all other payments?
I can only speculate, Your Honor, but I suppose it would be just to provide some guidance, some idea of what VA is looking for.
Well, does it say such as? You know, such as but not exclusively, or including but not limited to? The regulation doesn't say that, or the form that the veteran gets doesn't say that, does it?
The form says payments from any source will be counted unless the law says that they don't need to be counted. Report all income. VA will determine any amount that does not count.
Shouldn't that end the discussion? Isn't that fairly clear as to what the secretary is compelled to do? Cannot waive if the veteran or the appellant here fails to disclose income from any or payments from any source.
I would say so, Your Honor. And the form in the next page, Record 175, is simply providing more guidance as to what information needs to be disclosed. But you could arguably, you could make the argument that payments from any source will be counted closes the discussion.
Yeah, but the problem is the discussion is encouraged to continue by the secretary's action in putting these examples or these categories that need to be checked off. And perhaps the confusion in the mind of the veteran or the veteran's representative as to what needs to be included or maybe excluded.
Well, she was still able to understand the forms sufficiently enough to disclose retirement assets. So I would think that that would suggest some sort of financial literacy so that she would not be confused by the examples on the next page.
All right, I got it. Judge Toth.
Yeah, so I just had some general background questions about how the sort of pension system operates. On page 107 in the record, it says, the law requires us to stop your benefits effective January 1st, 2010, because your countable income of $7,988 exceeds the maximum income limit of $7,933 for a surviving spouse with no dependents in the year 2010. So is that a bright line where if you're north of the line, you get zero benefits, and if you're south of it, you would get full benefits, or is it sort of a gradation?
No, Your Honor, it's not a gradation. It's a bright line. The line has to be drawn somewhere, and that's simply where VA drew it.
And so she loses all of her benefits for the year because she's $50 above the income limits. The income limits set by Congress, right?
The income limits are set, but yes, they are.
I have to ask the million-dollar question. I mean, the 5302 uses the word equity and good conscience, and then that's in the regulation, right? And equity, I mean, just the understanding of equity is there are situations where people do not adhere to the letter of the law that, because of other considerations, they might still, warrant an exception or benefits. And that would be within the discretion of the executive agency to do so. Why not here? I mean, this is $50. She's obviously, it's not like she didn't disclose like Apple stock options or a private jet. I mean, by all appearances, I mean, she's a poor widow. Why does VA not take a position that the proper way to read the statute is just, it's an equitable matter. 1.965 lays out a bunch of factors that, would seem to, one of which is fault of debtor and other factors that would cover it, and that they would have VA has the discretion to sort of allow the waiver of the overpayment or not. I know it's a long question, but what about the equitable considerations? She's a poor widow. What are your thoughts on that?
I appreciate your concern, Your Honor, believe me. But I would note that the income is offset by her medical expenses, and below this cutoff point, and she would be entitled, had she met it, for like a portion of it, maybe not the full amount. She was given the full amount because she was based upon her disclosure that she had no income whatsoever. But to address your question, the secretary has to honor congressional intent, and the statute is clear. If there's any indication of fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith, the secretary is precluded. And that it was codified at 1.965B that says you don't even get to the question of equity and good conscience. If there is a finding of bad faith, if there's an indication of fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith, that's it. You don't reach the question of equity and good conscience.
All right.
But I mean, it would seem that the implication is that any repeated filling out of the form incorrectly would be automatically deemed misrepresented. I mean, she's argued in inadvertence, right? I mean, that's effectively her argument, you know, and I mean, there's some common sense to it. She's a widow. It's not immediately evident that, you know, unemployment insurance would constitute income. I mean, the, I guess my question is, your argument is that VA has their hands tied here, that this finding can only be deemed misrepresentation automatically, and that there's no way that you could even grant benefits here.
So, Your Honor, the board has to be so wrong here that this decision would be arbitrary and capricious. So here, the board is entitled to infer something more than an innocent mistake. This was a negligent misrepresentation, but it certainly found her not to be fraudulently misrepresenting her income. So, you know, for the board to find something more than an innocent misrepresentation or negligent misrepresentation, the misrepresentation must be consciously false and intended to mislead, and there must be an air of maliciousness to it here. That simply wasn't the board's finding. There's really no evidence of it. And the board did use willful. Well, that's more akin to saying voluntary, but not malicious. So willful does not equate intentional or fraudulent, because one can make a false assertion voluntarily or volitionally without knowledge of its falsity. That the board found willful misrepresentation, or that appellant willfully made the choice not to disclose her unemployment income on her application, is not the same thing as ascribing scienter to her, as appellant has argued. All the secretary needed to find was misrepresentation showing a minimal threshold of culpability. It had to be more than non-willful, that is unintentional or merely accidental. And when the board found appellant to willfully misrepresent her income on her application, or willfully fail to disclose her unemployment income, it was placing appellant's blame on a gradation between intentional fraudulent misrepresentation and accidental misrepresentation.
Okay. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. You know, it's two quick questions. First, the agency is not claiming Alpha deference on this. And second question, you can just take them, whatever. Is there a difference between misrepresentation and bad faith?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. That's indicated by the separate treatment of 1.965. They're both fraud and misrepresentation are laid out in one line. Bad faith is right below it. So bad faith, I think, seems to go more to like a course of conduct, and conduct is even referenced in bad faith in the regulation, whereas I guess misrepresentation could be single misrepresentation.
And for the deference, is she claiming our or Chevron?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat the question, please? Is the secretary claiming our or Chevron?
Our deference, right, because the board's definition would somehow warrant our deference.
No, Your Honor, we're simply claiming Chevron deference under the second. That the secretary's interpretation should be accorded deference under Chevron. As for bad faith, the board found bad faith when Mrs. Hayes failed to update VA as her income increased because of Social Security benefits and especially because of wages. The court addressed the issue of bad faith in Reyes, and although the board didn't cite to Reyes in its decision, I think if you read the decision as a whole, it does comport with the court holding. So under Reyes, the board should consider, quote, any evidence and relevant factors, unquote, bearing on the claimant's knowledge of, one, the need to report income, and two, her awareness of the income subject to reporting. Overall, the board did not find the appellant lacked the requisite knowledge of the consequences of failing to adequately report her wage income and her Social Security income. And I think In Reyes, it's important to point out that the court faulted the board because it failed to discuss the appellant's knowledge of his awareness of the income that he failed to report. Important to that case was the assertion there by the appellant that he failed to report his wife's income because they were separated and he was unaware of her income. It was really not a similar factual situation here. As for the first prong of the Reyes requirement, the need to report income, VA reminded Mrs. Hayes at least five times, and when I was going through the record, I counted seven times, to report all income, including Social Security payments or pension or other payments from anyone, which she failed to report, despite five to seven advisements from VA from 2009 to 2013. And in her March 2014 statement, she admitted that, quote, she did not pay. Yes.
Interrupt you. How did the VA discover these five or seven discrepancies or failures to report or failures that truthfully answer their demands or requests?
So she was sent annual letters by VA reminding her of the need to report any changes in her income. Those letters also noted that she did not need to file an income verification report because she had no income. So she didn't send in annual income verification reports.
Yeah, but we're back to the same question, and that is what was in the mind of the appellant in terms of what is income, right? What's wrong with this case being remanded to the board to deal with all the issues that we've raised in this argument?
Your Honor, even if the court disagrees with the adequacy of the board statement as to either bad faith or misrepresentation, as long as the board provided a decent explanation for one basis or the other, their independent bases, the court should affirm the board's decision.
All right, Judge Toth.
Oh, sorry. So I know the record mentions that VA now coordinates with, is it IRS and Social Security Administration? And are these, is this problem sort of resolved kind of globally now about people reporting Social Security benefits? And that VA has that information?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that that problem has been mitigated. I can't speak for certain, but one of the reasons it was implemented was why VA sought data matching agreements with the IRS and SSA was because of the difficulty of verifying income. So the situation has improved, but I'm hazard to guess it hasn't resolved completely. As for the awareness of income prong, Mrs. Hayes stated in her NOD and in her substantive appeal that she did not know unemployment compensation and Social Security income that she received starting in May 2012 counted as income. But as the board observed, she never addressed her knowledge of the need to report the most obvious form of income, her wages. So the board was therefore unpersuaded by her assertion about the lack of knowledge that Social Security and unemployment income counted as income. And the five reminders addressed her knowledge of the need to report income and specifically addressed which income must be reported, indicating that she was aware of the income she failed to report. If the court has no more questions, the secretary respectfully asks the court to affirm the board's decision because its conclusions about appellant's misrepresentation and act of bad faith are not arbitrary and capricious, and the secretary's definition of misrepresentation is based on a permissible construction of the statute. Thank you, Your Honors.
I have a question, and that is, if you follow, assuming equitable principles apply, is the secretary's argument that he was not arbitrary or capricious in denying the waiver here because equitable principles don't apply in the case of unclean hands. And that's what she's got by constantly failing to report this income or these payments, or even asking the secretary, gee, do these payments count? Am I required to report these? Is that your position?
Sure. Per the statute, we just don't get there. If there is any indication of fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith, that's it. That's the end of the discussion.
Well, don't you need some level of intent to get to any one of those three?
We're saying that this is not a strict liability statute at all. It would just simply need to be more than, I assume we're talking about misrepresentation. That there must be something more than an accidental misrepresentation or an innocent misrepresentation.
Well, there used to be a concept known as equitable fraud, where the appellant didn't, she made a mistake in not reporting this. The government relied on it in continuing to pay her. Now that it's been discovered, she's got a disgorge. Is that the concept you're rejecting, saying that we never even reached that?
I'm sorry. Would Your Honor please repeat the question?
Look, she didn't understand the full extent of her requirement of reporting. As the secretary understands it, should she be penalized in the form of the secretary refusing his statutory authority to waive recovery of the overpayment because of that? She misunderstood what her obligations were. She didn't intend to defraud the government. She just misunderstood what she was required to report. What's wrong? Why shouldn't the secretary exercise his statutory discretion rather than staying his hand, or rather than saying, we don't even reach that point because she didn't report at all?
Because this is more than an innocent mistake. She has to have shown that she believed the statement to be true and that belief was reasonable. Here, that belief was not reasonable because the March 2009 application specifically asked her to disclose all payments. So we don't even get to the question of equity and good conscience.
All right. I understand. Anything else, Judge Lauer? Judge Lauer?
Thank you. I do have a question. I'm sorry. Mr. Staley, you define the term non-willful that's used in Section 1.962B by relying on the definition of the term willful, but the regulation here could have used the word willful and didn't. And so my question is, if the secretary intended the regulation to require willful action, then why not specifically use that term in the regulation?
I think I understand your question, Your Honor. So It has to simply be more than non-willful. I can't speak to why that specific word was used, but it would appear to that a common understanding of that term would be unintentional.
All right. Well, just to follow up very briefly, there is this notion of willful misconduct that the secretary deals with every day when dealing with a veteran's entitlement to veterans benefits with an other than honorable discharge. You're familiar with that concept, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So to follow up on Judge Lauer's question, why not apply the same standards that the secretary must apply in the context of willful misconduct to hear whether they use the term willful or not?
Because that's from a very different body of law within veterans disability benefits law, Your Honor. We have to go by the congressional intent. We have to go by the face of the statute and go by the regulation, which prohibits us from getting to the question of equity and good conscience.
All right. Anything else from my colleagues?
I just have a question. I mean, the forms don't communicate anything about the income level in a given year that would put somebody over or under, do they?
It's my understanding they do not, Your Honor.
Okay. And you know, because there's nothing, I mean, she could have waived, not taken on a shift or something. And, you know, if she had fallen under the $50 mark, would she have qualified for benefits? In my question earlier, I mentioned that 7,988 number versus maybe the 7,933. And just how much information, I mean, obviously VA is telling them what they have to report, but they don't have much information as to what exactly the income level is to qualify for the benefits. Maybe she might want to waive some unemployment insurance or waive a different benefit, because that might end up, she might end up in a much better place. Just, you know, getting it under the number and then satisfying being allowed to receive a VA pension.
I see that run out of time, Your Honor.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you. So, Your Honor, a pension is reduced by all qualifying income and then perhaps increased by the qualifying medical expenses. But you're correct that the level is not laid out in the forms.
All right. Anything else from my colleagues? Judge Lauer, Judge Toth? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we'll turn now to co-counsel for the rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. The board's decision is erroneous and must be vacated. We ask the court today to ensure that there is a clear definition for the term misrepresentation. Additionally, the board decision is erroneous as the agency bears the burden of proof here and has failed to meet that burden. This is crucial as there's harmful error here supporting a need for a remand. Mrs. Hayes has been barred.
Sorry to slow your roll here, but so if you had to take issue with one of the two, which one would it be? Either the definition, right, or i.e. the interpretation, or the actual finding, right? So one would be the idea that VA just simply has defined, it's interpreted this concept of misrepresentation wrongly, and that's really where we should focus on as a court. Or in the alternate, it's simply that these facts here do not justify a finding that this was not inadvertent. Do you understand?
I do understand. Thank
Which
you.
Which one of those two would you go with if you had to kind of go all in on one?
The facts of this case really make it clear that it's actually important for the court to ensure that there's a clear definition here. We've been here before, not in front of this panel, but we did have a prior joint motion for remand in which the secretary agreed that the application of the term misrepresentation to the findings and or to the facts were not supported by the findings by the board in, I believe, 2018. We went back again and have found ourselves here because we've been further into the mud of what this term means. Without a clear definition, we will not be able to move forward and have a clear understanding of this term, not only for this claimant, but for other claimants in the future.
All right. So what do you want us to do? What definition do you want us to apply?
We would ask that the Black's Law Dictionary definition be used. That Black's Law Dictionary was used when the court looked at the term bad faith in Reyes. We do think that the term as defined in Black's Law Dictionary does implicate a higher intent standard. As these judges as Your Honors have noted, it's not a strict liability situation, and the secretary has agreed that it's not a strict liability situation. There is a need for a specific level of intent. The Black's Law Dictionary definition would ensure that the intent of Congress in creating this entire remedy of waiver, as well as the exceptions of bad faith, misrepresentation, and fraud, are all satisfied.
Well, let me ask you this. What's wrong with the Merriam-Webster definition as opposed to the Black's Law Dictionary definition? What about everyday English usage?
The Merriam-Webster's definition is not clear, and unfortunately, I think would lead us right back here. The Merriam-Webster's definition as I have in my notes, is an intentionally or sometimes negligently false representation made verbally by conduct or sometimes by non-disclosure or concealment, and often for the purpose of deceiving, defrauding, or causing another to rely on it detrimentally. There's a lot of maybes, often, sometimes. That's not clear.
That seems to help the veteran more than the Black's Law Dictionary definition in this context. But that's just what it seems to me.
I think, Your Honor, I'd have to disagree. I think the lack of clarity actually makes it more difficult for innocent claimants to get caught up in this dragnet. And the board has a lot more leeway, the agency has a lot more leeway, which was not the intent of Congress. If you look at the 1989 amendments to 38 U.S.C. 5302, as discussed in Reyes versus Nicholson, the intent of Congress was not to allow for most people to be weeded out from the remedy of waiver, but rather for most people to be able to get waiver unless there was an exceptional finding of dishonesty or fraud. And the congressional intent here is the only thing we really have to look at, unfortunately, because the secretary, despite having the prior remand and knowing that this is an issue, has expressly failed, as Your Honor stated earlier, to make this more clear and has failed to provide a definition. Congress intended for waiver to be the default.
Got it.
The need for a definition is very, very important, as this court has noted. The secretary here seems to agree that the statute is ambiguous, which moves us to the second step of Chevron. There, the court must look to whether the definition through the regulation should be afforded deference, and must look to whether the statement is an official position rather than an ad hoc statement. There's no indication that this definition of misrepresentation, as offered by the board in the decision on appeal, is an official position. As Your Honors noted earlier, there is no precedential opinion by the Office of General Counsel of the agency. There's no indication through notice and comment that the secretary has even attempted to define this term. And in fact, if you just look at the record before the agency, there are multiple definitions offered by the board in 2018, in 2019, by the secretary in his briefs, and even today, the secretary adds yet another element discussing that there must be a maliciousness to the misrepresentation. That term is nowhere in the statute or anywhere else, and there's no indication that that level of intent is what should be applied here.
I'm sorry for interrupting, Ms. Berner, but sure. If the board found that misrepresentation using a more restrictive standard, then how can you show prejudice in arguing here that a less restrictive standard should apply? I'm having trouble with that.
Not sure I fully understand your question, Judge Lauer.
So the board actually used a more restrictive standard in its decision. Mm-hmm. And my question is how you can show prejudice if, in fact, the board used that more restrictive standard.
Sure. So in terms of the term misrepresentation, first, I want to point out that the board has no real foundation as to where it came from. We have no indication that this could happen to someone else. Mrs. Hayes, the claimant in question here, has had multiple terms of this or multiple definitions of this term used against her in this same situation. There's no reason that the board could not turn around and give another claimant a totally different definition without any recourse for the claimant to have a clear understanding as to what the term is. Furthermore, we still think even if the court agrees with the definition as used by the board for misrepresentation, there is an inadequate statement of reasons or bases as to whether Mrs. Hayes had the requisite intent. As my co-counsel argued earlier, the only direct evidence of her intent is from a statement in which she clearly had no intent to seek an unfair advantage and she did not have the requisite knowledge. There's no other direct evidence that she had the actual intent to prove either bad faith or misrepresentation.
So what do you make of, and I think in some ways it's the most difficult fact in your argument, which is the five or seven times that she filled out the forms, right? I mean, the sort of repeated nature of it. I mean, I assume maybe you don't understand it one time you read it, but by like the fourth or fifth, you should get an idea that, oh yeah, all sources of income must be reported.
I can understand the court's concern about that question, and I appreciate the question. There's no information in the record that would actually indicate whether the claimant had the education, the knowledge, or any other equitable considerations to actually go to whether she understood the forms or whether she understood the import of not following the forms or not perhaps filling them out correctly. But those all go to the factors of equity and good conscience that the VA Committee on Waivers and Compromises looks at when considering whether a claimant is eligible for remedy, or rather for a waiver. This claimant is completely barred from even getting to those equitable questions by this regulation and by the board's application of the term, because this clear, or this rather unclear, but this very strong bar against claimants who have an indication of misrepresentation, fraud, or bad faith does prevent her from even being considered for that type of issue. And we think it is paramount, given the 1989 amendments to the statute, that Congress did not intend for this to be, as my co-counsel eloquently stated, an insurmountable bar for all claimants to even be prevented from reaching that committee. The committee was created for a reason and has the discretion to look at the equitable factors, but the secretary, through these actions, is preventing her from even being able to reach that place.
Anything else, counsel?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Anything else from my colleagues? Judge Toth?
No, thank you. Thanks to everyone.
Judge Lauer?
No, thank you.
Thank you all very much. This has been very helpful to the court, your argument, and the written submissions beforehand. And the matter is submitted. Thank you all very much.
And the court is in recess.